last spring or winter, which is that if that the partition functions of the partition function of a 3D n equals 2 theory in the so-called ellipsoid geometry, S3B, where B is an ellipsoid deformation of the 3-sphere, has a factorization into a sum of products. So the ellipsoid partition function depends on some complex mass parameters mu and on the deformation parameter b. And the observation was that it takes this kind of form. A sum of products b of xq, b of x tilde q tilde, where x, maybe I'll do it here. So x is equal to e to the 2 pi b mu. X tilde is e to the 2 pi over b mu. Q is e to the 2 pi I b squared. Q tilde is e to the 2 pi I over b squared. And so it has this kind of factorization, and she noticed that these b's looked like BPS partition functions of the theory, something you get by taking an index on R2 cross S1. Then in work with Davide and Sergei Gaiotto, for a few reasons I'll get into later, we kind of conjectured that the index of the sphere index of a 3D n equals 2 theory should have a very similar factorization. And so for the index, it looks like this. So the index depends on an integer m, a fugacity zeta, and parameter q. So in standard, let me explain what these parameters are. One considers the theory, call that ZB. One considers the theory on S2 cross S1, where it's an S2 bundle over S1, and S2 is spinning by an amount q. You form a Hilbert space of states on S2 with some magnetic fluxes for background gauge fields. Background gauge fields associated to the Slaver symmetries. And these are the m's. Compute minus 1 to the f or to the r, q to the j plus r over 2, zeta to the e, where r is r charge, j is the spin that couples to angular momentum. It couples to the spinning of the sphere. And e is a Slaver charge for U1 symmetries. Probably too much detail for now, but this is the index of the theory on S2, and the point is that it has exactly the same form. How does the board? Oh, of course. It has exactly the same form as I wrote for S3B. So it's factorized into the sum of these blocks. But now the identification of variables is different. So for the index, x is q to the m over 2 zeta, x tilde is q to the m over 2 zeta inverse, q is q, and q tilde is q inverse. Okay. So quick summary of a quick way to say what we did with Chris and Sarah was to formulate a more precise conjecture about what these blocks are, these B's, and to try to explain why the S3 and S2 cross S1 partition functions and possibly other partition functions should be written in terms of them. In particular, why identical B's appear above and below. We also propose a new way to compute them. So we conjectured that for a certain class of theories, the compact partition functions will always factorize like this, and we give a way to compute the blocks so you can actually test the conjecture. Along the way, there have been kind of a lot of surprises, and we've discovered a lot of beautiful mathematical, analytical, and some physical properties of these blocks, which I'll try to get to throughout the talk. The plan is to say a little bit about geometry first, and give a definition for these holomorphic blocks. And discuss a few of their properties, which I will try to motivate geometrically. And then I would like to do two examples, which I think illustrate how things work. The main one will be kind of a trivial example that ends up having most of the interesting non-trivial properties. Just the theory of a free chiral. And then I'll do a more interesting one that has multiple vacua. And that would be the CP1 linear sigma model. CP1 sigma model. Now, to start, in fact, before I say things about geometry, I should say which theories this actually applies to and what kind of theory I'm thinking of. These blocks are observables or invariants such of n equals 2 SCFTs. With a U1 R symmetry. And also sufficient flavor symmetry to make them massive. And what I mean by that, is that for a maximal torus of the flavor symmetry group, a maximal abelian subgroup of the flavor symmetry group, say u1 to the n, one can turn on real mass deformations, a real mass deformation for every u1. Call them MI3D. So their values for the scalars in a background gauge multiply associated to the symmetry. When they're all zero, you've got yourself a CFT. Otherwise, you've made things massive. And in order for any of these partition functions to be defined, these masses have to be turned on. Otherwise they all give you infinity, and through that infinity equals infinity, but it doesn't tell you much. This idea of turning on mass deformations also gives some control over renormalization group flow, and I think ultimately it allows you to calculate anything you would want in the UV. So these objects should all be invariant under RG flow, and the efficient way, or the only way to calculate any of them, is to realize a CFT with a description as a gauge theory in the ultraviolet, and then compute what you want and say that whatever you've computed is actually a property of your CFT in the infrared. So examples. I should tell you what alpha is. So the kinds of theories I have in mind are things like the IR fixed points of SQD or SQCD or theories with superpotentials, as long as the superpotentials preserve U and R symmetry. And this includes the entire class of three manifold theories that Davide and Sergey Lukov and I wrote down in the last few papers. So these are theories in class R, labeled by a three manifold, which should come from putting M5 brains on the three manifold. I want to comment on that briefly, but first let me tell you what the alphas are. So I want the theories to have massive vacua, and in fact the actual constraint for making these sums of products well defined is that they have massive vacua after being compactified on a circle. So I'll take a theory T and on R2 cross S1. Then all of these real masses get complexified. And it's nice to define an exponentiated complexified mass parameter. So if it's a circle of radius beta, there's a complexified twisted mass in two dimensions, which is naturally periodic. So for every flavor symmetry, I've got a background flavor field, and I use its holonomy to complexify things. And then the statement is that for generic values of the x's, the theory has massive vacua. And the massive vacua are alphas, as I think you may have all assumed by now. So alpha parameterize the vacua in R2 cross S1 at generic values of x.
Excuse me. Just some simple question. So in this symmetric QED, everything is a massive.
Right, so you need typically to add a little bit of matter or something.
Supersymmetric, yeah.
And it's supersymmetric.
So there's a no gapless excitation.
Sorry?
Including, but there's always a gauge field, right?
Yes.
So only the matter part is a massive.
So you're playing in three dimensions. So
basically, you have a transform term which also gap the gauge field.
Exactly. So you don't. The gauge field. Your theory is gapped.
So everything is gapped.
Yes. You're playing in three dimensions, so you have transcendence terms, and also your Yang-Mills couplings get infinitely strong in the infrared.
Okay.
I can try to make it a little more precise, but the you compactify things down, and all your fields get eventually dualized to scalars if you're far low enough in dimension, and then the effective potential for all of those scalars should have massive vacuum.
But if you're in a three-dimensional large manifold, thus everything is gapped without going to reduce dimension.
And I think the answer is yes.
But if you need to turn on every possible mass, all the phi two of parameters.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you turn on phi Eliopoulos parameters that make your Coulomb branches
even
massive.
This massiveness is important enough for you to get your results.
Sure.
Okay.
If it's not, then you might have some kind of integral and need to think about how to regulate it.
The theory he's studying are CFTs. So he studied CFTs by doing a canonical mass deformation of the CFTs.
I see.
So because supersymmetry, there is a very canonical way to deform the CFT to the massive theory.
I see.
And you can hope that you can still learn things about the original CFT.
Okay.
But you may also have some sick cases where you just don't have any way to deform it. And then I'm not quite sure what the answer is. Cool. So let me make a quick comment about the three-manifold theories. So when applying this construction to the three-manifold theories, one gets a duality between the blocks and transignments, a certain analytically continued transignments partition functions on M. So if the theory is T of N, labeled by a three-manifold, say with KM five grains on M, then these blocks should be transignments partition functions on M labeled by a flat SLKC connection. And for typical three manifolds, the set of flat SLKC connections is finite and has no deformations. Just as you might say for 3D CFTs, upon generically mass deforming, the vacua are finite in number and all massive. But I don't think I have time to say much more about that. I just want to point out that there is a nice connection. Now let me motivate geometrically why those sums of products have any right to be true. So there's a very naive explanation for how the factorizations work. It goes the following way. Let me start with S2 cross S1. One can take S2 cross S1 and stretch it into two semi-infinite cigars cross S1. They're related by gluing with, the boundary of each cigar is a torus, and the tori on the two sides should be glued together with some elements of the modular group. And in this case, they're glued together by the identity element and a reflection. In the case of S3B, we can do the same thing. Well, mainly speaking topologically now, so we can take S3 and stretch it out into a union of two semi-infinite cigars. But now the S1 on one side is glued to the cigar on the other side and vice versa. So the boundaries are identified with the element S of the modular group, plus a reflection.
Sorry, by stretching, do you mean taking an extreme squashing limit of the manifold so that you are considering a special regime of the parameter
No.
space?
No. So taking B to 0 or infinity gives you half of it and kills the other. It gives you, so taking taking B to 0 or infinity basically gives you R2 cross S1.
So what do you mean by stretching?
I mean topologically. I'm just making a rough topological picture that it is possible to decompose both of these spaces into a union of solid tori, or I think the right statement is that they're both Lens spaces, and so they have decompositions like this. I'm not making any statement about the metrics, but I'm about to. So I'd like to define the block as a partition function on one of these semi-infinite spinning cigars. Well, I want to make it spin, I should say. So let me fiber D2 over S1. So that say in complex coordinates, the coordinate on the cigar gets multiplied by q as they go around S1. And if I try to put a supersymmetric theory on this and want to preserve supersymmetry, I should do something. And that something is going to be a topological twist. One way of saying it is that I turn on a background connection for the U and R symmetry equal to plus minus half the spin connection. Plus, I am completely free to add something, to add a flat piece to that. And I will add a flat piece that has holonomy I pi around the S1. I may explain why that's useful later. Anyway, this geometry preserves 2 out of 4 supercharges. And exactly which 2 it preserves depends on the choice of sign here. So often the plus sign is called a topological twist, and the minus sign is called anti-topological. Is there any colored chalk around? Possibly not. No, it's fine. It would clash with decor. Good. So this is topological. This is anti-topological. And the way I actually want to define the blocks is to use the topological twist if Q is greater than 1, and use the anti-topological twist when Q is less than 1. I'll try to justify in several ways throughout the talk why that's something reasonable to do. Good, so back to the picture. To get the index, I should draw in here. To get the index, over on the left side, it's around S2, the supersymmetry algebra is deformed in some, thank you, in some non-trivial way, but relevant properties is that the S2 is actually spinning around the S1. It's the same idea. It's fibered over S1, and it spins by an amount Q. So one would imagine that to try to reproduce something like that over here, we can take 2 cigars and have them both spinning in the same direction as viewed from outside of the board. But what that actually means in the cigar's own orientation is that one of them is spinning by an amount Q, and one of them is spinning by an amount Q tilde, which is Q inverse. And that's the first kind of trivial relation that you see in this factorization. Q tilde is Q inverse. With a little bit more work, you can try to compute Wilson lines for flavor symmetries at the 2 tips. At the 2 tips of the cigars, and find that the exponentiated Wilson lines look like q to the m over 2 zeta on one side and q to the m over 2 zeta inverse on the other side, where m is monopole number. It's the amount of flux of a flavor connection, well, the curvature of a flavor connection through S2. Also, I should stress that it's important if the construction on the right-hand side, which I've just defined, has any rights to reproduce the index on the left. I can't topologically twist both sides because that would give me a unit of R flux. It would give me a unit of R flux through the entire S2. And so it has to be a topological twist on one side and an anti-topological twist on the other, so that the R flux cancels out and gives me the R flux that I have over here. And so this is, should say very clearly, this is a three-dimensional lift of the TT star geometries that Chakotay and Vatha considered many, many years ago. So I should somewhat suggestively write the sum of products as B XQ modulus squared with the identity. It's identity fusion. Okay, so likewise up here for S3, I should probably move somewhat faster.
Sorry to interrupt.
Yes.
There is a much less sophisticated way of getting this by not introducing the cigar.
Yes.
Stay on the S3 and localizing the Higgs branch. That's it.
So.
Both for S1.
Is this. I'm not sure. So none of the localizations that are done so far actually.
It can be done. So for example, for S1.
No. I agree.
So for
it S2
and S1,
be done.
You can just leave the two dimensional story and you get it on the nodes. In the S3, you have to choose the right queue. You have to use the right supercharge.
Yeah, and I think I agree with you. So I think the S2 cross S1 story is exactly a lift of what you did.
It's a matter of picking the right supercharge or the right localization.
In S3, I think you have to use a different supercharge because the one that people used before
and is not
doesn't rotate. Q doesn't rotate.
Yes.
But that's just picking a different element.
I agree.
Yeah.
So you do exact deformation.
Yeah.
Or you choose a different localization. I should have said these words before. This probably can all be explained very nicely with some localization calculations. But I just don't know what they are. They're not what we tried to study.
In the case of index, there's no other option for choosing Q if you have enough fugacities. So that should be achieved by choosing different Q exact deformation.
Yeah, sorry. I think for S2 and S1, you just have to choose a different deformation term.
But
for S3, you have to choose a different Q, but that's...
Yeah.
That would be really cool to see. So the main conjectural part of this, which I think you're trying to say is not that deep and can actually be done, is that there is some deformation that preserves partition functions in spirit, some Q exact deformation that takes you from round geometries on the left to these topologically, anti-topologically twisted cigars on the right. So we approached it from another perspective. We said, hey, over here on the right, we can actually compute things and we can define some observables of the theory, which are basically the modulus squared blocks with the right parameter identification.
At the end of the day, is this the R2 times one vortex partition function?
Yes, modulo subtleties. So yes, modulo subtleties. Let me get there. But yeah, basically, that's what I was trying to say. It's basically that. But that's exactly what you get from a topologically twisted cigar. That's how you would define. It's one way to define the 3D lift of the vortex partition function. Except you don't even need a gauge theory in this case. You just need.
You can do all of this without ever topologically twisting. You can in the untwisted theory and do it there.
How?
Just add a different QV, a different deformation.
Essentially, okay. You have to choose a Q that squares into a rotation that essentially.
If you knew a localization that. So it's what you guys did over the summer for S2. It's if you knew a localization that localized to vortices, basically localized to a point times S1 at the North Pole and South Pole, and to vortices at those points, then you would be done. And then there would be no stretching, no topological anything required. And you could do it in both cases. You're absolutely right. So maybe I'm a few months behind the time. But let me try to at least explain some nice things that come out of looking at this in terms of infinite cigars.
There's also you are going to define an object VA by itself, self-consistent. This, which is not something that you get out of localization on its true on.
Well, it's going to be the vortex on partition function R2 times S1.
Yeah, but I think he's going to put enough ingredients to make it into a well-defined object other than this sort of hand-waving.
It's not hand-waving. Okay, we'll see.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, in the very large space-time limit, the theory became topological, I understand, because it's massive. So whether one have this kind of factorization for this transaminant topological theory in three dimension, or so maybe this is a generalization of this factorization for transaminant topological theory.
I don't think it's never actually topological. The whole thing is not.
No, do you have the limit? We just mentioned this. This is whole, everything has a mass gap, but then you take a limit where space time scale is very very large.
Yes.
So in that limit, you know, like a mass goes infinite limit, then that's kind of like a topological field theory limit. So I wonder whether one can make a connection. In this limit, one can make a connection
with
some result of a topological field theory.
But I think that's exactly the spirit. So you're taking a limit where you've frozen things out at the gluon. In a sense, you can try to say if you want the theory to have finite energy on an infinitely stretched geometry, it had better be sitting in a massive, well, it won't be finite energy, but minimal. It had better be sitting in a massive vacuum. Sorry, no. Good. Finite energy, supersymmetric vacua. It had better be sitting in a massive vacuum the entire infinite middle part of this stretch. And then on either side, it is topologically twisted. And so what you get is effectively is exactly computable in a topological field theory.
So in the topological field theory, do you have this kind of factorization?
You wouldn't need it. In a topological theory, you don't need to stretch anything.
You don't need stretch, but whether
you
the
just cut wherever you want.
Have this form of.
Well, sure. So transignments on Lund spaces, which is what's going on here, has this S matrix that glues kind of trivial contributions together on the two sides.
I see.
Maybe that's something to emphasize that this is this type of argument, this cutting and gluing, is extremely easy to do in topological theories, and not understood that well in supersymmetric ones or conformal ones or so on.
The same trick can be applied to supersymmetric theory with dynamics.
That was one of the motivations. Yes. Thanks. So I'll just say very quickly that simply by requiring a consistent gluing of two semi-infinite cigars with glued together by an S transformation, one again reproduces the identification of parameters on the left. I will make it sound trivial, though it's actually not if you do it carefully. It's a Jacobi transformation on variables x and q coupled with an inversion. So if I set q to be e to the 2 pi I tau, then q tilde is e to the minus 2 pi I minus 1 over tau. So the inversion gives you an extra minus sign. And then q tilde is e to the 2 pi I over tau, which is exactly the transformation for q in the S3B geometry. And the transformation on x is exactly that of a Jacobi variant.
So the extra minus sign is for orientation reversing.
It's because you're gluing these. Yeah, you're reversing orientation in the gluing. It's the same minus sign that came up for the inference. I should put a big caveat in there that this is. Again, this is an intuitive explanation of what's going on, but if you try to work it out, you find that things don't depend on the radius of the cigar because you're topologically twisted, so it's only the real part of tau that enters into Q and things like that, but it all works out quite nicely. So having done that, let me tell you what how much mileage there is to gain from the stretched picture. So first, because everything is topologically twisted, it's trivial to expand the geometry out from cigar cross S1 into R2 cross S1. In other words, to take the radius of the cigar to infinity. And perhaps trivial is too strong a word because you still have to know something about a boundary condition at the end. But let me just be intuitive for a second. So one gets a spinning R2 times S1, which is exactly the setup that computes what you're calling the vortex partition function. In this, the partition function in this geometry is an index. If I leave the Hamiltonian part of it out, it's n minus 1 to the r, q, so if I topologically twist, it's q to the minus j minus r over 2, x to the e. Where you use a flavor fugacity. So it looks, in principle, very, very, very similar to the sphere index over there, except the fugacity is complexified. And the Hilbert space is not well defined without a boundary condition at infinity. And that's a choice of vacuum. So having picked a vacuum on R2 cross S1, you can try to count states, and you get an index that looks kind of like, well, it looks exactly like this. The tricky part is how you actually count the states. In three dimensions, everything is marginally bound, and so you get into complications with which single particle states you count, which multi-particle states you count. And I honestly don't think those are resolved anywhere in the literature, and I don't think we do a very good job of resolving them in this paper. What I will say, though, is that there is this heuristic argument coming from topological string theory, where these indices are extremely frequent. That says that this should be given by an Ogori-Vafa type expression, or it should be given in terms of Ogori-Vafa invariants. So again, this is heuristic. Should take a form of an infinite product so it's an infinite product over the charges R, J, and E and a product over some spin modes, which I'll get to in a second, roughly didn't even write it down roughly q to the minus j minus r over 2 minus n x to the e minus 1 to the r, and then an Noguri-Vafa invariant. So what are these n's? So each n is the degeneracy of some chiral field that contributes to the index. At least this is the way they suggest things should be counted. So for example, a free chiral as a field on R2 would be split up into, well, it would be split up into angular momentum modes. A tower of angular momentum modes on R2, and then a Fock space is built out of these guys, and thinking of a gas of free particles, one gets an expression like this. It's a very useful thing when you have a finite number of free fields in your theory, and it's completely useless if you have an infinite number of fields or an interacting theory, because you have no a priori way of computing anything about the Noguri-Vafa invariants. But this is one thing that the block should be related to. And if I want, so let me call this ZBPS of X and Q. There's a Z anti-BPS as well, where the sign of the R symmetry gets reversed, and in fact, the flavor fugacity gets complex conjugated and inverted. But I'm not sure it's that useful to write it down. The block then gets defined, or should be, should be defined as the BPS partition function when q is greater than 1, and the anti-BPS partition function, an inverted fugacity when q is less than 1. And one of the surprising things that happens is that these regimes end up matching quite nicely. I'll try to give an example in the case of the free chiral, but it makes sense to split things up like this. This index that I wrote down abstractly is what you would call the three-dimensional lift, or the k-theoretic lift of a vortex partition function. So there is a limit. If you have a gauge theory, it has dynamical gauge fields, you keep the Fi parameters fixed, and then you scale all the masses and Q and get down to vortices in two dimensions.
So if you're interpreting this B alpha into the as a vortex partition function, I'm slightly confused because I don't think you have specified your theory in too much detail.
Yes.
And depending on gauge group choice and matter content, can't we just have theories without vortices in their spectrum?
Yes, you can, but nevertheless, this is well defined. What's called vortex partition function is a subsector of this.
Okay. Soliton viewpoint, can you give some words on what else they could be?
Well, I just said what it was. So it's you're counting. So one of these is counting BPS states, and one of them is counting anti-BPS states, depending on the topological twist or not.
Is it central charge or something still given by vorticity or some similar topological quantities?
Yeah. So. I don't understand. So you're asking about the fugacities? So let me tell you how to take a vortex limit. So in three dimensions, I didn't make this clear enough. In three dimensions, there are all these flavor symmetries, but the topological flavor symmetries and the regular flavor symmetries that act on, say, chirals are on the same footing. In the IR, you have no idea which is which. So in these U1s that I'm associating masses to, the masses are masses for chiral fields and Fi parameters. I'm sorry, I didn't make that any clearer. So over here, there's this x, but x is actually a vector of things. And say x1, for any mass parameter, in terms of the two-dimensional limit, one would want to scale it. One would want to set x equals to e to the beta m, where m is the complex mass in two dimensions. And that comes directly from that complexification formula I had over there. On the other hand, for fi, call that x, so let me call it y, for an fi parameter, the fi doesn't scale when going down to two dimensions, or it possibly scales like a power of beta in a very, very different way. And q is e. The usual way it's written is q is e to the beta epsilon. In the current notation, it's 2 pi I beta epsilon. Doesn't really matter. So the limit is so if you want vortex counting, you have to pick what your fi parameters are, because in two dimensions, if you want vortices, it's important to have a gauge group. So you separate variables this way, which looks absolutely asymmetric from three dimensions, and then you take a limit. And you get to vortex counting. Does that answer?
I'm slightly confused, but I'll ask you afterwards then. Okay. I'm just worried about, supposing
you can call Negrasov partition function an instant partition. Omega, you can compute the omega deformed partition function for the theory. Oh. Even if for the theory is not a gauge theory, you need to have no instantons.
Well,
and you can still
sure.
call it instant
okay.
partition function.
Oh,
nobody's going to shoot
slightly
you.
Slightly abusing terminology, okay.
Yes.
Okay, that is completely fine with me, yeah.
It's
best.
It's a much better, quick answer. Good. Okay. So the other perspective on this. So this is one side. You expect the blocks to be BPS partition functions. The much more interesting perspective is keeping the cigar at finite radius, zooming out, and seeing that macroscopically, the cigar times S1 just looks like a line segment, or a half line. So this becomes R plus. In the quantum, so it's a quantum mechanics with four supercharges. There's a complex superpotential. And one can actually do the dimensional reduction, at least perturbatively, and figure out what the potential of the quantum mechanics should be. The picture one gets from this is that the blocks, this is, again, very, very similar to TT star, the blocks should be written as an overlap of kind of a ground state defined by the twisted spinning tip of the cigar and the basis of supersymmetric ground states in the asymptotic region. A fairly short calculation that was done by Nekrasov and Witten shows that just explicitly, if you're playing this game with the gauge theory, the equations that govern the vacua on R2 cross S1 that I defined initially, is the way I defined my alphas initially, are exactly the same equations that govern the supersymmetric ground states on T2 cross R. So these are in one-to-one correspondence with vacua. Though as my parameters, x and q, are varied, the correspondence could jump. There could basically be tunneling between the ground states. So generically, they don't interact with each other because the quantum mechanics has too much supersymmetry. But at special values of parameters, they might. And then the correspondence between vacuum and ground states jumps, and what you get is effectively a Stokes phenomenon. for the blocks. So crossing one of these loci in parameter space, so it's in the space of, by parameters I mean x and q. So as I vary the masses, say, I cross a locus where the blocks could jump by a matrix such as this. And where one vacuum picks up a contribution from another. This kind of Stokes phenomenon only makes sense if, well, it requires a consistency check. It requires that the fused partition functions don't see it. And what that ends up implying is that the topologically twisted and anti-topologically twisted blocks had better see conjugate Stokes rings, or had better have conjugate Stokes jumps. So for example, for q less than 1, the blocks as a vector may jump by some matrix m as I cross this locus in parameter space, but then at q greater than 1, the blocks should transform with an inverse transpose so that the product is invariant. And that's another, it ends up being an extremely subtle property mathematically of the actual functions that give the blocks. The last thing that comes from quantum mechanics, I think my long overview has been a bit too long, but I'll just give the result. Try to say what we get out of it. So the other thing that comes from quantum mechanics is a prescription for how one should actually compute the blocks without hand-wavy BPS counting. And what results is, well, it's a path integral for quantum mechanics. So these were considered a long time ago and then described beautifully by Witten in a paper a year or two ago. Doing the dimensional reduction from three dimensions to quantum mechanics, if you start out with a gauge theory, say in three dimensions, one finds that the dynamical fields in quantum mechanics are basically the complexified gauge scalars. So very roughly, one obtains an integral over the Coulomb branch of the 3D theory. We call them DS. So these are complex gauge scalars. One is integrating an operator insertion. Coming from the tip of the cigar, kind of where I associated my state 0q, I'll say what happens in the bulk in a second. But the boundary condition at one end of this half line is simply a weight in the quantum mechanics path integral. It gives this operator. What I'm actually integrating over are the values, the possible values that the fields can take at the origin, which is why it's not an integral over infinite dimensional field space. And the integration contours come from the boundary condition at the infinite end. And I am realizing that I don't think I can do this justice in the moment right now. But if you will at all believe me, this is what comes out of quantum mechanics. One gets a rough idea of what kind of expressions should calculate the blocks, and it looks very, very much like a localization expression, except for this crazy choice of integration cycles. So the integration cycles are not fixed. they're in one-to-one correspondence with the vacua of the theory. They're critical points of this weight. And if you want to compute all the blocks, you have to consider all possible integration cycles. And so this is the way we actually propose to compute things, which works rather beautifully.
Maybe this is helpful, maybe not. If you look at in the two-dimensional setup now,
yeah.
You look at the Langdon-Ginzburg model. Essentially, what you end up getting for the full partition functions, the two blocks. Essentially, that integral time is complex conjugate.
Yeah.
And in some sense, this is kind of factoring that integral into whatever it's called. I mean, the omega omega bar type of integral into contours.
Yeah. That's exactly what it's doing.
So what is that W? I mean, are you going to tell us what it is?
So it should be the homomorphic block with the values of the gauge fields, the dynamical fields fixed to backgrounds, or the gauge fields fixed to background values. I think it's the easiest way to say it. So you have a gauge theory, say,
mm-hmm.
Where the Lagrangian contains a bunch of chiral matter and transcendence terms.
Mm-hmm.
You pretend that the gauge fields are non-dynamical. You write down the holomorphic block for this product of free chirals with a bunch of transcendence terms, and then integrate the thing. At least that's, I think, the most intuitive way of saying what should come out of the quantum mechanics setup. Good. So I will get to an example in the last 10 seconds. But I do need to say one more thing. So just as there are TT star equations in two dimensions, there are difference equations in three dimensions. So the blocks, and this is quite honestly how we fixed all the little ambiguities and so on, the ones we could fix for the holomorphic blocks. So acting at the tip of the cigar, there are a set of line operators that sit at the tip and wrap S1. There are flavor Wilson lines and Itthoff lines. So there are Wilson lines that multiply, that just multiply the blocks by X. There's one for each U1 flavor symmetry. And there are Itthoff lines that shift X by Q. This is the algebra of the operators, but in three dimensions, the operators are related. They're not independent, and they satisfy word identities. And the word identities for any 3D gauge theory, we sorted out with Davide and Sergei how to write down systematically. And the block should give a solution with certain analytic properties. It should be a holomorphic function, again, satisfying a little bit more. So there are some difference operators. They take the form of polynomials in X, P, and Q that annihilate all of the blocks. And one way to characterize the blocks is this as a basis of solutions to these difference equations. Of course, you want to pick the distinguished basis that actually corresponds to vacua, and there you need to know about something like integrals and supersymmetric quantum mechanics. So I'll quickly do the most fundamental example, if that's okay. And so I want to consider a theory of a free chiral multiplet except so it's got a U1 flavor symmetry that just rotates the phase of the chiral. But in all of the games I've been talking about on the board, flavor symmetries and gauge symmetries are actually not that different. And one is turning on background connections for the flavor symmetries. So the flavor symmetry had better be non-anomalous. And in three dimensions, chirals give half integer transignments anomalies for symmetries. So we add a level minus a half bare transignments coupling for the U1 to cancel what might come out of the chiral. And let me call the parameter of that U1 x. Good, and the R charge, the chiral is going to be 0. That's not actually important. Okay. The S3B partition function is usually written in the form of an SB function, a non-compact quantum Bell logarithm, which involves B and some parameters, some complex mass parameters mu, but it can beautifully be factorized as long as you go off of the unit circle. So Q is 2 pi IB squared for S3B. And if you're on the unit circle, there's absolutely nothing you can do. But if you move either slightly in or inside or slightly outside the unit circle, then there's a factorized expression. 1 minus q, 1 plus r, x, 1 minus q tilde, minus r, x inverse, x tilde, inverse, for this SB function. And I've written it in terms of the variables that I beautifully just erased from the board, where x was 2 pi b mu, x tilde was e to the 2 pi over b mu, and I have q up, and q tilde is the same thing if b goes to 1 over b. Similarly, the index has the same form, and it was almost written like this before, and then we, with Davide and Sergey, we wrote it in exactly this structure. So the index of the tetrahedron theory. Well, so this, sorry, I'm not going to say why it's a tetrahedron theory. The index of the free chiral has the same structure, but you just redefine what you mean by x and x tilde, which tells you what the blocks ought to be. Had better be the case that one gets a product, 1 minus q to the r plus 1 x inverse, when q is less than 1, and a product 1 over 1 minus q to the minus r x inverse when q is greater than 1. Now, one of these is topologically twisted, and one of them is anti-topologically twisted, so there's no reason that there should be any relation between inside and outside the unit circle. But the wonderful thing is that there is. There's no analytic continuation. It's fairly easy to see that both of these functions either blow up or go to zero uniformly at the unit circle, depending on what x is. However, they can both be expressed as the same convergent Q hypergeometric series. Which converges both inside the unit circle and outside the unit circle to two different things. And so this is one of these surprising properties of blocks that we find that seem, so if you start with this for the fundamental ingredient, then everything out, all the other blocks you compute seem to end up having the same property, that inside and outside the unit circle, topological, anti-topological, you've got the same convergent Q hypergeometric series. Even though each one, so B of x tilde, and q tilde, neither of them make sense on the unit circle, when you put them together to form S3B, you can suddenly analytically continue exactly to the region you need. for B to be physical. Okay, that's the block, and it satisfies a difference equation, which is kind of the fundamental thing that generates all other difference equations.
Does this equation require x to be smaller, bigger than 1?
Sorry?
Does this equation require x to be bigger
than 1? So the series does.
Or
it
just...
So I think it requires, it depends on whether q is in one of the regimes. So I think if q is greater than 1, then the denominator roughly goes to 1, and then you need x to also be greater than 1 in order for the numerator to converge. However, you write it like this, and then you can analytically continue to all of x. So that's a straightforward analytic continuation, unlike what you can't do in Q. So there's a difference equation that looks like that, that says B delta of QX, Q is equal to 1 minus X inverse B delta of XQ. And it's easy to see that both of the infinite product forms satisfy that. It's just that one of them makes sense when Q is less than 1, and the other one makes sense when Q is greater than 1. And good. That was, I think, all I can say there. So for the last bit, I wanted to give a quick example for something that had non-trivial vacua and some block integrals. I'm not sure if there's actually time for that. So maybe I'll wrap up. Right, so I'll wrap up quickly, then anyone who would like to leave can do so, and I'll put the projector on for maybe 5 to 10 minutes, and I'll give some examples of block integrals. Last thing I should say about the word identities is that, so the reason that in the previous papers we suspected that indices should have any kind of factorization at all, and that it should be related to S3B, was because you can explicitly show that the fused partition functions, the index and S3B, satisfy two sets of word identities for commuting sets of line operators that basically act at the north and south poles. Mm-hmm. And they're exactly the same ones. It only depends on the local structure of the theory and of near the fixed point of your U1 symmetry. Given that, if you know that some non-holomorphic function satisfies a holomorphic differential equation and an anti-holomorphic differential equation, the natural stupid thing to do is to write it as a sum of products of holomorphic times anti-holomorphic that each satisfy the difference equation. I think that's kind of mathematically reason why blocks should exist. I've tried to give you the physical reason why they should exist. So thank you very much. Let me turn the projector on if anyone is interested. Or should now I take some questions? Or just turn it off. Can I hook this up? So it actually should be hooked up. And I just press that on. So if you all turn around, it's projected in the back of the room. I can see it beautifully.
Is it coming down?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is an example with multiple vacua. CP1 sigma model, I will think of it in the ultraviolet as a linear, as a gauge linear sigma model. There are two chirals that both have the same charge under a dynamical U1 gauge symmetry. And the flavor symmetries are a U1 vector and a topological U1, which shifts the dual photon. The masses I'll call x and y, and so y is secretly a complexified Fi parameter. The parameter space in three dimensions was studied in an old paper by, I think, Dorian Tong. Now I'm drawing the parameter space on R2 cross S1. So all of the x's and y's have been complexified, and I'm taking a typical slice. And so what does it look like? In one regime where the magnitude of y is becoming very, very big, it looks very much like a sigma model to a CP1 Higgs branch. So in three dimensions, that's exactly what it would be, except I've compactified and complexified things a little bit. So in three dimensions, on going up to big Fi parameter, it looks like a sigma model to CP1. If the Fi parameter is small or negative, you get quantum sigma models to CP1s. In two dimensions, so in 3D it has some massless rays. In two dimensions, it's massive everywhere except the origin. So basically anything I turn on for x and y will make it massive, which is exactly the situation I want to be in. There are two vacua, which you should think of as the north and south poles of CP1, either in the quantum case or in the classical case. Which means that we should be getting two blocks. And I'll talk about the Propel arrays in a second, but they're going to be where...
You have two blocks per north pole and two blocks per south.
No. You have one block for the north pole and you have one block for the south pole.
But how come you don't have one block per vacua at each of the poles?
Sorry? No. I said this poorly. There are two vacua. They correspond to the north pole and the south pole.
Or the CP1.
On the CP1.
Oh, CP1. Okay, so sorry. Yes.
It's the sigma model language.
Okay.
So if x is zero and your Fi parameter is very big, if x is close to zero and your phi is very big, what you have is effectively a semi-classical sigma model to CP1 that's slightly massive, so you've kind of made the north pole and south pole massive. Modulo complications of the Wilson lines you turn on in two dimensions. But that's only the description going up, going to the left or to the right. There are other descriptions for effectively the same thing, but the vacua will start interacting with each other. There are difference equations that look like this. Again, I claim that they can be systematically derived just from the Lagrangian. There are two parameters, so there should be two difference equations. They basically fix everything up to constants. Since they're second order in the shifts, we expect to get two solutions, which are the two blocks. The block integral looks like this. I haven't defined some things. The Q infinity symbol is the block of a chiral. So it's what I had written on the board underneath the screen. It's the thing that's defined, so it's that infinite product that's defined one way when Q is greater than 1 and one way when Q is less than 1. In fact, the entire integrand is defined one way when Q is less than 1 and another way when Q is greater than 1. So these are the contributions from chirals. They're infinite products, and you can see the fugacities for the gauge symmetry S and the vector flavor symmetry X. Now, There are some transimons and FI terms involved. The whole thing altogether shouldn't have any transimons terms. But there were secretly transimons terms in the theories, in the chiral theories, that there was minus a half that get canceled. So now I'm pointing this at this and saying it's transimons terms. It looks like a bunch of theta functions. So in localized expressions for S3B or S2 cross S1 partition functions, transimons terms come up as quadratic exponentials. They look like Gaussians. Right? The classical transimons action for an abelian U1 looks like a Gaussian. But a Gaussian doesn't have the right analytic properties to be a block. It has branch cuts. It's a Gaussian in log of x and log of, it would be in log of x and log of y. And it would involve log of q. But if you want a function that has the same transformation properties under difference equations, obeys the same difference equations as a Gaussian and is analytic, the natural thing to do is to write down a theta function. And so that's what's being done here. So the theta functions are there's an FI term.
But do you get this from the quantum mechanics?
No, you can only do the quantum mechanics perturbatively. And I think the origin of these theta functions is something I've been talking to Davide about the last few days. There's something tricky about the boundary condition that allows you to fix these things non-perturbatively. So from the quantum mechanics potential, all you get is a Gaussian. And then what we did is simply postulate that the blocks should be analytic. They shouldn't have branch cuts. And so by Gaussian, I mean it looks like 1 over log q log x squared,
mm-hmm.
Which is an extremely unpleasant thing to put in a nice integral like that.
But the quantum mechanics should give you the answer.
If you know how to do the quantum mechanics calculation non-perturbatively,
yeah.
It absolutely should give you the answer.
Yeah.
And we're working on it. We really don't know yet. It seems to be extremely, extremely subtle. Because non-perturbatively, you get a potential like this, which has multiple sheets, and you need to sum up over sheets or do something like that. So I don't know, but it's not because I haven't tried. So what I can say at the moment is that the theta functions work, and I can motivate physically, so you can do consistency checks with them. You know that if you take two chirals that have r charge 1 and couple them in a superpotential, they both become massive and can be integrated out. But if they're two chirals that are in these T-delta theories, they each come with minus a half transimons level. So how do I create minus 1 transimons level? I couple together two T-delta theories, shift the r charges so that I can have a superpotential with r charge 2, and integrate them out. I should be left behind with the transimons level. And a theta function by the Jacobi triple product, oh, I wrote it down here, is really looks like it's nothing but two chirals with appropriate R charges. There are several other consistency checks involving Ogori-Vafa type arguments for the BBS index. It seems right, but there is something physical that I think is interesting and is missing. So we have the integrand, and we have to pick the integration contours. And we want to pick a basis of contours by looking at the critical points of the integrand, which are the vacua of the theory, and flowing downwards according to gradient flow. So downward gradient flow for the absolute value of the integrand. The integration, so this potential, the absolute value, right, the log of the absolute value of the integrand is plotted there. There are a bunch of poles and zeros. The zeros come from theta functions, from these resolved transcendence contributions, and the poles come from the two chirals. There are two half lines of poles going the same direction, which means that you've got two chirals with the same gauge charge. And this what I'm actually plotting is a cylinder in terms of the complexified gauge fugacity. So the log of S is a real line, and the argument of S is periodic. And I want to try to find integration contours in this cylinder. There's kind of an obvious way to do it. Now, I've plotted this when the Fi parameter is huge. That's what lets me find an obvious choice of vacua. They're going to be at the north and south poles, and the integration contours are very easy. They each encircle the chirals, and you can sum up residues and get that expression for the blocks. This is when Q is greater than 1. And they're written in terms of what's called a Q Bessel function. We talked about it at lunch the other day. So you do this for when Q is greater than 1, but then you notice. So you could also try to do the integral when Q is when Q is less than 1, but at best you can do it numerically. However, you notice that this thing converges in both regimes. It's just like the chiral block. It converges both when Q is less than 1 and when Q is greater than 1, but it converges to two different limits, and it's two functions with actually different analytic properties. And what I don't have up here is that if you actually assume that the block when Q is greater than 1 and is in the two regimes is given by the same series, you fuse them together and you get the correct index and the correct S3B partition function. So the last cool thing about this is that you can start messing around with parameters and having your vacua interact. And how it looks like for these critical point cycles is that one cycle picks up a contribution from another. So the natural cycle associated to vacua down here in this kind of quantum CP1 Coulomb regime, this big cycle is the sum of the two cycles up there. So the natural Q greater than 1 blocks, which are being computed by this integral, are linear combinations of the ones above. And I also had better have that the blocks at Q less than 1 are conjugate linear combinations of the blocks in the first region. So another miracle that happens is that even though I'm taking different linear combinations, I'm doing them in two regimes, and before and after the jump, the blocks are still written in terms of the same Q hypergeometric series. So there's an obvious identity when the blocks stay the same, and there's some kind of three-term identity when the blocks jump that lets me keep writing them in terms of these hypergeometric series. That's a mathematical statement. I already said what the Stokes walls were. It's a mathematical statement, but it can be tested with mirror symmetry. So that picture had a beautiful degree 3 rotation symmetry that switches up the Higgs branches into Coulomb branches. And it acts on the parameters just as I've written it. XY goes to those combinations. So I would imagine that if I plugged in that transformation into the blocks, I would get the blocks in a different chamber. Because from the point of view of the mirror symmetry, the regime where an Fi parameter is huge in one mirror frame is the quantum regime for another mirror frame. So the kind of the semi-classical regimes that I computed my Q Bessel functions in change. So in this case, mirror symmetry should be the same as a Stokes jump. And in fact, it is. So I apply the mirror symmetry transformation stupidly on the blocks, and I say, well, these transformed things must be the blocks I've computed in the new chamber. And they are, in fact, related by the linear combinations I've given here. And they're different linear combinations when Q is less than 1 and when Q is greater than 1. That's how they're related to the original blocks. This is one of the things that made us fairly confident that the whole thing is working. That's it. Thank you.
You take the Q goes to one limit, do you get the integral representation? Gerasimov from someone else has a...
Right. But you showed me that paper 2 days ago, and it's probably similar. So just from what I saw in your office, it looks similar. So I think you were trying to tell me that there seems to be some magic like this that happens for the vortex partition functions as well.
Even though they did it backwards in some sense, I mean they were clever and they were able to massage the full vortex partition function into contour integral, but there should be a way of deriving this kind of from localizing differently.
Yeah.
Just like you.
Yeah.
So, although
at the level of formulas, a lot of these just kind of reduce stupidly down to the two-dimensional expressions, this seems to offer some enlarged perspective on how, and globally, how the vortex partition functions should be made.
So these two differential equations you have go to the differential equation for Bessel function.
Yes.
To how do you call it, the recursion relation for Bessel function.
Yeah, so the two variables, there's the argument of the Bessel function and there's mu or whatever.
And yes, now they are on the same footing.
And here they're absolutely on the same footing. And so it's because when you take the 2D limit, as I wrote it over here, you scale the FI parameter and the mass parameter are different.
Was the K-kinetic partition function for CP1 computed before?
Yes, in a kind of beautiful way. So I will tell you the nicest way to think about it. You go to the infrared in three dimensions, you go to two dimensions first. So you go all the way down. You don't keep any KK modes, and then you try to lift back up using K3. So in two dimensions, you've got a sigma model from CP1 to CP1. You have a sigma model from R2 to CP1, but you have to pick a massive vacuum at infinity, which says infinity either goes to the north pole or the south pole. So you have CP1 to CP1, and then you're counting maps. And it's very easy to write on the moduli space of maps from CP1 to CP1, and you compute some equivariant character of those moduli spaces, which is exactly what these cube Bessel functions are. So Y is the degree of the map. You asked about K3. If you actually plug in parameters that the blocks have, then the numerator involves y, which is the degree of the map, it's the applied parameter, and then x is rotations of the target CP1, and q is rotations of the base CP1. And there are mathematicians who did this very carefully.
I mean, you can also do it with a GLSM point of view.
Hmm?
Also from the GLSM point
of view. Yes, so I assume it can also be done nicely from a GLSM point of view. But there it's just, of course it's been done. There's a topological string computation that I know you don't like that, but there's it's the 3D lift of the vortex partition function. It's very easy to write that down.
So do you think this K theoretic calculation could actually be this sort of Higgs branch localization?
Yeah.
I don't know. Because it sort of maps from CP1 to CP1 might also correspond to something that's happening in Higgs branch.
Yeah, I think these results are, in some sense, studying the theory on R2 times S1 with an omega background and on.
Yeah, absolutely. That is in some sense what you're doing, but I don't think it's a very precise sense.
Yeah.
There's an omega background, and there's how you deal with Kaluza-Klein modes, and that is exactly what it should be.
I mean, these theta functions they are adding, I haven't seen before. They seem to be important to make things work.
Omega background in three dimensions is defined by twisting. So it is exactly this R2
right.
Cross QS1 geometry. There's nothing else. But then there's another limit where you go down to two dimensions with an omega background, and you include the KK modes, and you claim that you get the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not entirely clear.
I think there's
the
next speaker.
Oh, great.
Oh.